listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Reading Joy Harjo, the top of my head feels the presence of sky above my body, feels the presence of four directions, and my mind is filled with thoughts of how we enter and how we exit this world, how we become the person we're meant to be. In Crazy Brave, her magnificent new memoir, Harjo, an internationally known performer and writer of the Muscogee Creek Nation, explores her own journey to become an award-winning poet and the author of 7 books of poetry. As she has observed, and I can attest, a memoir teaches you to write it. This memoir, which she has written, is a powerful teacher to author and to reader both. From growing up in Oklahoma, the end place of the Trail of Tears, and learning to escape her abusive stepfather through her imagination, to attending an Indian arts boarding school, to becoming a teenage single mother, Harjo eventually finds her poetic voice, which we will be blessed to hear tonight. Karen Taylor is the founder and executive director of Write Girl, a creative writing and mentoring organization for teen girls. And I think there are some Write Girls in the audience tonight. Is that correct? Are you here? Somewhere out there? We welcome you. Karen has served as publisher and editor for all of Write Girl's award-winning books, and she herself is a poet, singer-songwriter, and mosaic artist. So, to begin tonight, Joy is going to play a flute solo, and I'm going to read one of her poems. So, in order to do that, please join me in welcoming Karen Taylor and Joy Harjo to the Los Angeles Public Library. It's from Joy's writings from Comings and Goings. When you wake up in the morning, go outside. Turn to the east. East is the direction of beginnings. It is sunrise. When beloved sun rises, it is an entrance, a door to fresh knowledge. Breathe the light in. Call upon the assistance you need for the day. Give thanks. When you go out, you will see that the birds are out singing up the sun. The plants, too, are turning in that direction. And at dusk, as sun leaves us, return to the station of remembering. When sun leaves, it makes a doorway. We have access to eternity. Breathe out. Ask for forgiveness. Let all hurts and failures go. Let it all go. The birds and animals turn inward and let go, as do the plants. We are all in the ceremony together.
Well, that was a lovely way to start. Different kind of conversation without words. Your music reminds me of what your book did for me, which feels a little bit like a warm blanket. And as I read it the second time, it felt like there's this interweaving of poetry in the parts where you're writing poetry, but also even in the prose. So this question kept coming to me about how did you find your voice? How did you find that way of writing that is so distinctly Joy Harjo?
That's a good question.
Start with a good one, right?
You know, I think it's just there. Someone asked me a question today on the, there was a chat on Goodreads, and I said, well, you can't, as people always think, how do I find my voice? And you can't really go chase after it. It's like if you go chase after love, it's going to run away from you. You just have to be. It's like your voice, it's right there. And it's something, I think it's something larger than me. And there's times when I've tried to go outside the voice to write something that I feel is more with the time or with contemporary, because I feel like my voice is a very old voice and it's something that's beyond me. It's beyond me. I kind of grow into it and then it changes. Everything is always changing. But it's, I don't know, it surprises me sometimes because it's there. And it's the same voice, I think, with the poetry, with the music, with speaking, and it's the and dancing, because I love it. It's the same kind of voice. And then doing a memoir, a memoir is a lot different from writing plays or writing poetry or music.
It's
a different kind of creature. It's narrative. It's a narrative, and the narrative goes out. Well, I was 14 years behind contract on this book. Because I didn't want to write this story. This was the story that I realized later. I mean, you come to know these things later in the process. As I realized later that I was running away from the story. I was running away. I would be asked in interviews, well, what about your childhood? Let's tell me something. And I knew what they wanted to hear. They wanted to hear grandmother sitting in a teepee telling nice stories, you know. You know, that's...
And you didn't there's not very much of that in this book, I'll tell you.
I ran from this story, and so I thought, okay, why did I sign up to do a memoir anyway? Because I don't really want to talk about myself. But I decided I first did it as short stories. The first short story, it just fit, everything fit. Part of it is in The Flying Man, the little part about the trapeze artist that comes up and talks to me at the circus when I get the idea that my then husband, who was running around with his high school friends and losing jobs left and right, I got the idea that he could become a trapeze artist.
And that's one way of remaking your husband.
Yes.
So how did you get to the 14-year point? Like what happened then that made you say, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to write this memoir? Because I think a lot of people have that feeling, like they have a book in them, they want to write their story, and how do you know when it's the right time to do so?
Deadlines. My editor, Jill, it was a couple of years, I'm getting written about a week, I'll be at the Taos Summer Writers Conference, and she was there the summer before last and said, we're calling your book in. I had no idea I was 14 years late. In fact, I would not look at the contract until I got her in. I sat there with it, and I said, I'm just going to write it. I had all this stacked. I mean, I had rewritten about half of it, of the short stories. And I realized it wasn't working because you know these things when you're working on a creative thing. It's not working, even in your life, which is a creative thing. This is not working.
You know when it's not working, yes, indeed.
We've got to find another way around this, or your country. You know, this is not working. Because it is a story. It is a story that we're all writing and rewriting. And so I went around and... I realized it wasn't working, and I had all of these charts. I had every, you know, I stacked the stuff. And then I just said, okay, voice, the voice that is wiser than me and has been carrying this story, because I could see it. I could see the story all done here. And I knew it was there. And so I just let go. I thought, okay, Just, I'm going to write, and I'm not going to be afraid. I'm just going to write.
And become crazy brave.
And that's what happened.
Yeah.
But then even then, I still went through in that time. I probably revised it. I gave a copy of that, a copy to Jill, and she really liked it and gave me suggestions, and I got the suggestions back. And then I said, you know, it's not working for me. I rewrote it totally again. You know, it used to be 150, 200 more pages than are in here now. And and then it wasn't working for either of us. And then I redid it, and then it just kind of pulled. It's very distilled.
Well, that's like poetry, too, which is always described as using economy of language and distilling it down so that the poetry is really like a sculptor of, you know, taking away what's not, what the excess is, and leaving you with just the kernels. I wanted to ask you about that because I feel like so much of your memoir includes sort of poetic language. You talk about your parents, and this passage kept coming back to me. My parents are 80 and 90, and I went to visit them. And your passages of your father being of water and your mother being of fire kept coming back to me, and I kept making a Right Girl writing experiment about it, like what kind of element are your parents? You know, I think my mother's cinnamon. She doesn't, you know. But I wondered how you came to this place of describing your parents in that way and identifying them. You know, that passage you write about them being fire and water was so powerful. How did you come to describe them in that way as part of the elements? Was that it's like part of the theme of your book in many ways, is the nature and the elements?
Right, and then I think of my mother. My mother was very outgoing, and at the very end, I was revising this as I had gone back home to help my mother die, or to be born, because I was there with her, and I realized I was midwifing her. Of course, I didn't realize that consciously. I was in the process, and she moved to the other side, that I realized I just midwife my mother. But that was the final. It was strange. It's uncanny how the timing was. It's like the book was being done when it needed to be done. Mm-hmm. But you try to explain that to an editor.
When you're getting under contract.
But so my mother was very fiery, and she loved to sing. And my memories of her were always dancing, at least until the life became very unbearable. And my father was somebody who had a lot of gifts. I think the problem with him, you know, he had a father, but as I said about some of these men, is they had no father map.
What does that mean?
A father map. You need someone there to, as I said about, I think my son's father, is that he had no father map. And so how do you know? You don't have the tools to get, you know. And we can go out and acquire tools in different ways. But my father was like water. He was like water. He didn't, his communication went on in other ways, not in...
Verbal.
Not verbal. He wasn't a very verbal person. But his feeling, and I was the one probably closest to him, is that, and I'm still close to him. He still comes to see me. He's very deep. It's like he came in with all of these gifts that came down through. In our family, in my father's side, we're related to almost every leader in the tribe. Everybody from Manahui, who fought Andrew Jackson, to Osceola, the Seminole Warrior. I mean, all of these, Samuel Shakota, the first principal chief. You know, all of this stuff that, and you know, came through him, and he, you know, he was in Oklahoma at a time when to be an Indian man was, you know, what do you do with a warrior society in a place where, you know, it's a different, you know, I mean, we always need warriors. We always need, you know, among us, male and female.
Well, we call them leaders.
Yes.
Or CEOs.
Yeah. Right? And so I understood, I mean, I understood in a way without knowing that I absolutely understood as a child that he had all of these gifts and he didn't know how, you know, there was no place for them. And so he, you know, he
He had other outlets or other limitations, perhaps. I wanted to ask you about your ancestors because they figure so heavily in your book in such a beautiful way. I mean, there aren't these big passages of your ancestors, but there's sort of little, little lines back to them. Did that figure heavily in your mind as you wrote? Did you feel like they were sort of present during that?
I think they always are for all of us. It's not something that's just me or for, you know, Asian people or Native people. I mean, we all, this, what you see here, you know, we're just, everybody in here is just like the little, I hate to use cliches, the tip of the iceberg, I hate that. But, you know, we're just right, what you see walking around is only just the, what's not, you know, that's only just a little bit of it.
Particles.
There's a huge story matrix, you know, a huge story matrix, and there's so many connections.
Yeah, I have to read that line, actually, because that one keeps coming back to me, too. A story matrix connects all of us. There are rules, processes, and that's Canadian, processes. There are rules, processes, and circles of responsibility in this world, and the story begins exactly where it is supposed to begin. We cannot skip any part. That's so beautiful. I don't have a question. It's just really beautiful. you know, I'm always curious about the writing process because, you know, with Write Girl, we're always trying to help girls uncover their stories and write about their journey. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about your writing process because I can't get a picture on it. Like, do you write in the sun with a cat on your lap, and you write freehand with a pen or on a computer or every day or for 5 hours at once? Like, I don't know what it looks like, and I so want to know how you did this.
Oh man, it wasn't pretty.
No sunlight, scratch the sun, the cat, just put that
I
on.
Really admire people who are like clockwork, you know, they, you know, their lives are, you know, they get up and they know they're going to be in a certain place. And I've been making my living performing and writing and trying, and that's what I've been doing, but I've been traveling a lot to make a living. And I never know where I'm going to be when I'm home. I was home for a month and a half, and I finally settled into where I could, I think I wrote like 8 new poems in the last month.
Wow.
And I've got a new song. I was playing a little, I don't have it, it's not finished, or I would do it for you. But I've got a new song. I've got a show that I'm writing. I mean, I'm researching, I'm learning blues bass, and I've made friends with Selby, who runs the Oklahoma Blues Hall of Fame, and so I've been learning blues bass for this, because I want to do a show that rewrites the story of American music to include Native people, because we were there when jazz was invented. You know, Congo Square was Muskogean ceremonial ground. And yet we're always left out. So anyway, all that to say is that it's great when I'm in one place, because then it's things start to settle. But being on airplanes and dealing with bags and, you know, it's just that clatter. And yet I get energized by being in different places and meeting people. I like what I do.
We could skip the airport part of it. It would be really great.
Yes, that would be great. But I've learned to write, and I think with a little bit of noise going on, just because I started writing with two young children as a single mother. And so you learn, if you're going to write, you're going to have to write through anything, you know, and you're going to have, you know, you find times to, you know, you find places to write.
Quiet moments. Would you read a passage for us?
Uh-huh.
We have choices. But that first one, page 52. A story from your childhood?
Okay. The kitchen chairs were red vinyl. The ice cream churn was propped by the back steps with a pile of blankets, waiting for my father to make ice cream for us as he promised. The story veers from here. In one version, my father laughed as he stood up to make the ice cream. We children followed him, jumping up and down in excitement and anticipation. I was the oldest, the one who got to sit on the blankets that covered the churn. He turned and turned the crank until the ice cream was made. My mother dipped us each a bowl of delicately flavored ice cream made from fresh peaches. We sat out on the steps and ate of the sweetness until we could eat no more. In the other version, my father continued his drinking party. The house was a roar of music and bravado. We were no longer in the yellow kitchen with my mother's plants that wound around the windows, hundreds of leaves and vines in response to her singing. We were in the alternate realm of the kitchen. It was the kitchen of hunting rifles, deer blood, and car parts soaking in grease. It was the house turned over in the dark. My father would get angry. He would get angry because his mother died of tuberculosis when he was a baby, because his father beat him, because he was treated like an Indian man in lands that were stolen away along with everything else. He would punch and kick in anger because something in the house was not right. The dinner is not right. My wife is not right. And where are the children? What's wrong with them? Aren't they in bed yet? It will never be right as long as you are angry, I wanted to say. But who was I to say? Because I was a child. And because I was a child, I cowered under the table to hide when he started coming my way in anger. My cowering made him even angrier because I was not brave at all.
I love that idea of the, you know, you catch us so strongly in one version, blah, blah, blah. And don't you want to go like, what's the other version? You know, like it's so sort of suspenseful even as it's poetic. Love it. I have this other passage that I keep coming back to this part you write about whiskey, tequila, tobacco, all are potent healers. There's a reason why they're called spirits. You must use them very carefully. They open you up. If you abuse them, they can tear holes in your protective spiritual covering. What does that mean?
Well, how long do we have? I mean, anything that I mean, literally, I mean, there, it does happen. I mean, you think about it, you've seen people who are really out of it, and you think, who is that person? You know, something else comes in, and, you know, something else gets invited in or is able to come in. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, good words that heal, or words that, true words, words are very powerful. Scott Momaday has a wonderful essay about the power of words. And he talks about the Kiowa poet and writer and artist, and he talks about how his grandmother came about, you know, in a time when words can literally change the weather, words can call things into being. And that a proliferation of words becomes cheap, and then we forget that we're living in a world, I guess, called into place by words. And in fact, we're calling the world into place. That was my iPad.
The iPad has a way of calling,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, just thinking of.
Got to cut the tequila off of the iPad.
So anyway, there's more. I said I could go on for an hour and a half because we are literally, you know, covering ourselves with what we say. We're making our path. And anything that we do in excess, I mean, it's about balance. And anything in excess, I mean, because in our tribe, we use tobacco. But you see what happens with overuse, you know, tobacco abused, and then tobacco abused by adding all of these sugar and all this additives to it. Mm-hmm. The same with corn, the same with other plants, and so on and so on. That's another.
Yeah,
another.
We've sort of lost reverence for some of the more mystical qualities of some of those spirits.
And for ourselves, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, because, you know, in the world of words, I guess in the world where we understand the power of words, we understand the power of poetry. And we're in a society. I mean, if you look at American society and the way American society views or understands poetry, it's not like other countries. It's not like other societies in which poetry is how we know our soul.
It's really cast aside to the to the, you know, if there's time, we'll do poetry at school, you know. If not, it gets cut. And I think maybe the only time we've all heard poetry was at the inauguration. You know, that was sort of one moment when poetry got a spotlight. Oh, don't get me on my soapbox. Poetry needs a stronger place for sure. I wanted to ask you if there was anything in the process of writing this book that surprised you. Or, I mean, there probably were a few things, but was there anything that really sort of struck you as you were writing it that you discovered about yourself or about your history that you really didn't know before writing it?
I think one thing that strikes me, has been striking me lately because things will come at you in different ways, is how conscious children are. You know, often we talk down, people, you know, old adults talk down to them, but if you think about your own childhood, it's intense. You're basically as fully formed in spirit as a child as you are now. You're basically who you were. I mean, we change. We've got sometimes go through dramatic changes, but that person is still there. And I think that's what struck me about writing this and going back and feeling like, you know, as a child, there were a lot of things that I knew. There was a certain wisdom. You know, even if people say, well, this isn't what's going on, but you know better. But even perceptions into, you know, very deep psychological perceptions and knowing are there. And so it's made me actually, I think, after is to really think about that in dealing with even, you know, babies and children and young people. You know, yes, there's an age, as a baby is a baby, but there's, I don't know about you, I'm sure everybody's seen this, when you hold a newborn, they still remember everything. There's that moment before they sleep, that's why they're sleeping so much, it's the sleep of forgetfulness. But when you're hold, you know, when they first out, that's when I can really communicate with my grandchildren. I mean, they remember where they come from. And they're still, you know, all of those memories are still there. And then they sleep and then, you know, and then they're with us here.
And then they get an iPad and...
Yeah, and then that's another story. That's another long...
Would you read another passage for us? Mm-hmm. The one, I love this one, the beginning of that next chapter, the... South chapter, the direction of release. I think it's page 135.
Yeah. Okay. When I lived in Tahlequah, and this was, I lived there, I went to Indian boarding school, I became a member of one of the first all-native drama and dance troupes. I was a high school, one of two high school members. We even went on tour, and then I was pregnant and nobody knew that I was a teenage mother, and I went back and wound up living in Tahlequah, the Cherokee capital, with my son's father. He was older than me, and I was, yeah, I was, okay, so that's how I was in Tahlequah. When I lived in Tahlequah, which is the Cherokee capital in Oklahoma, when I lived in Tahlequah, I used to walk through town, up and down hills, along the creek, by storefronts filled with items I had no money to buy. I walked when I was hugely pregnant, and then after my son was born. It was my time alone. As I walked, I could hear my abandoned dreams making a racket in my soul. They urged me out the door, up or up in the night, so they could speak to me. They wanted form, line, story, and melody, and did not understand why I had made this unnecessary detour. Think for yourself, girl. Your people didn't walk all that way just so you could lay down their dreams. I wanted more, and I didn't know how I would get it. My days were consumed with the drudgery of survival. I took care of the household, made meals of beans, fried potatoes, and cheap meat. I negotiated with a husband who was essentially a boy. He didn't know how to grow up. His father had abandoned the family, and he had no father map. There were flashes of inspiration and joy. I saw my son sitting by the screen door making dirt parachutes, his fine baby hair lit up by the sun, singing with the radio. See me, feel me, touch me, heal me. And my stepdaughter in a striped jumper with balloons in honor of her fourth birthday climbing up swings in a park. But this wasn't enough to sustain the need for artistic expression. I believe that if you do not answer the noise and urgency of your gifts, they will turn on you or drag you down with their immense sadness at being abandoned.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. I think I have to say that's one of my favorite passages from the book because it sort of encapsulates a lot of what you've done here in being able to sort of identify that wistfulness that we all sometimes feel of sort of what's my purpose here, you know? And the book has kind of made me want to look back at my own journey and figure out sort of where are the places where I have not been brave and where I need to be brave, you know? So it's kind of a self-help book too. There's one more passage that I would like to ask you to read as well towards the end of the book that kind of, I think, brings everything kind of together of all the parts of the book and all the parts of you on page 163.
Okay. It was the spirit of poetry who reached out and found me as I stood there at the doorway between panic and love. There are many such doorways in our lives. Some are small and hidden in the ordinary. Others are gaping and obvious, like the car wreck we walk away from, meeting someone and falling in love, or an earthquake followed by a tsunami. When we walk through them to the other side, everything changes. I had come this far without the elegance of speech. I didn't have the physical handicap of stuttering, but I could not speak coherently. I stuttered in my mind. I could not express the perception of the sacred. I could speak everyday language. Please pass the salt. I would like, when are we going? I'll meet you there. I wanted the intricate and metaphorical language of my ancestors to pass through to my language, my life. Much like the night I witnessed the healer become a poem in a far-off country, though in spirit nothing is ever far away, the spirit of poetry came to me. To imagine the spirit of poetry is much like imagining the shape and size of the knowing. It is a kind of resurrection light. It is the tall ancestor spirit who has been with me since the beginning. Or a bear, or a hummingbird. It is 100 horses running the land in a soft mist, or it is a woman undressing for her beloved in firelight. It is none of these things. It is more than everything. You're coming with me, poor thing. You don't know how to listen. You don't know how to speak. You don't know how to sing. I will teach you. I followed poetry.
That's so nice. So maybe this is the right moment for another kind of poetry. I know you have another instrument.
Yeah, I brought my saxophone.
Hanging out back here. Yeah.
Okay. I'll play a song, maybe two.
Yeah, that'd be great. Two? Yeah, we're already getting two coming out. Joy, can you just tell us the story of the tattoo on the hand?
Yeah, I got this about 7 years ago. And actually in my tribe, I did a lot of research. We tattooed extensively. And it was men and women tattooed, and they were usually marked different events. You can see a picture of my grandfather, Manahui, and he's got, you know, his face, he's got some tattoos on his face. Mm. And that was seven generations. Yeah, he was seven generations ago. And then with Christianity, it was forbidden and looked down on, and so people stopped tattooing. And then I lived in Hawaii for 11 years, and one of my friends is Keone Nunes, who is a Hawaiian culturalist who helped to bring back Polynesian tattoo art history. He's actually helped some of the tribes in California with the women with their tattoos. Anyway, I got this one seven. This wasn't Keone's. I've got Keone's elsewhere, but this one I got in. He recommended. I was going to Tahiti, and I kept seeing it on my hand.
Huh.
And it's Marcasian, because I liked Marcasian reminds me of my own tribe's art, and then some Tahitian.
Wow, it's beautiful.
And I always tell kids, you know, don't get your anybody's name tattooed. I mean, adults too. I always remember my daughter's Acoma grandmother with, you know, she was in her 80s with her. She still had her boyfriend's initials tattooed on her hand. Okay. See, that's what happened, is this was, you heard that sound. I'm trying to remember the words to one of these. That's what I'm doing. But I'm going to play, I know the words to this one. This is a love song. It's called This Is My Heart. It's in the book, too.
Oh, yes, I remember it.
Song. It is a good song. Walk forever the border of fire and water, of fire and water. To sing to you, to new wings quiver with vulnerability. Come lie next to me, put your head here. My heart is close enough to sing to you. Hey, yeah, hey, yeah. Anybody happen to have a copy of the poem Equinox? I'm trying to remember how the second verse. I want to do that one, and it's you got it. Yes. See if I can. I must keep from breaking. It's the second verse. I know. I must keep from breaking, and then I tell you this soon. But there's the second one. I could get started if I don't think about it. If I forget it, then I'll just play. I'll just solo. Yeah. Okay, great. It's this. It's
here. I found it.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Okay, I just need to look at one thing. Okay, I'll just set it up here.
Yeah,
from
sure.
I know it.
Love it.
Okay, this is Equinox, and this is. I was thinking I should have called. Okay. I was thinking I should call this Crazy Brave because it is almost like that. But I was standing waiting to be picked up for a performance way up north, and I was standing there at dusk at equinox, you know, that balancing out, and with that feeling in my stomach of, we all get that sometimes where we know we've been here before, we know the weight of the story, we also know the joy of the story, and it's almost indescribable, and it often happens at sunset, you know, that feeling. If you think, I just now, it's usually around sunset as the light's going down.
Change from one world to another.
Yeah, it is. It does. You do change from one world to another, one reality to another. And there's different rulers and different powers in that rule each of those places. And there's even rulers at the gateway or the doorways between seasons and between... Between
junior
day
high,
and between night.
Junior high and high school.
Yeah. Okay. From breaking into the story by force. If I do, I will find a war club in my hand and the smoke of grief staggering toward the sun. Your nation dead beside you. Oh, I keep walking away, though it has been an eternity. And from each drop of blood, each one springs up sons and daughters and trees. A mountain of sorrows, of songs. I tell you this from the dusk of a small city in the north, not far from the birthplace of cars and industry. Geese are returning to mate, and crocuses have broken through the frozen earth. Come for me, and I will make my stand before the jury of destiny. Yes, I will answer in the clatter of the new world. I have broke my addiction to war and desire.
What I mean about it feeling like a warm blanket, you know, the music, the words. I think I'm going to dub this whole evening like being in Joyland. Forget Disneyland. You got to go to Joyland. You read the book, you get the music, you have the whole experience. You talk about life, about the ephemeral. You know, we have time for a few questions. So Maureen's out there in the audience with a roving microphone. I'm really delighted that three Right Girl teens are here today. Thank you for taking time to come and be here. I hope you've been enjoying it. So I hope you have some good questions ready, maybe. Be brave. The theme of tonight is also brave, crazy brave.
There's a question over here.
Joy, could you talk about the structure of the memoir, the way that you divided it with the directions? At what stage did that come to you, and kind of your thinking through that?
That came towards the end, because I had different kinds of structures and so on. And it just came, it's a ceremonial structure, actually, because it's the east is where, at least the Muskogee, we start with the east and go north, and west and south. And so it makes, there's a whole circle. And in that circle you have, you know, creation, building, destruction is also part of it. And, you know, dissipation. I mean, it's a whole cycle. And that's how that came about.
Oh, it's interesting that it came towards the end, because you would have thought that you had the structure first and then you hung the book on the structure, but it kind of came the other way around.
It kind of all together. I mean, yeah. I wish I thought clean lines like that, but I don't. That's, you know, even if I'm trying to keep notes, my notes are all, they're like in different places on the paper.
Well, that's more how our brain works, is in clustering, not necessarily in linear fashion, too.
But, yeah, so it all kind of works, you know, I'm working on this part here, and this part is working here, and then it just kind of came together.
Is it like that for music for you, too? Do you work on music and writing at the same time, or are they separate?
Kind of together and separate. Like, I'm working on this song now, and I'm really, but there are, all the songs are different. It's like I have this really cool stuff going on with a bossa nova bass and rock drums, and I mean all this stuff that I'm putting together, and I'm actually taking a poem, Anchorage, but then when you start taking it and putting it to music, it changes. Then you have to take the poem and take it apart sometimes, because it fits differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know that you had a long process of doing your memoir, and it took you about 14 years to get to it. How important was it to finally put it on paper?
I think it was a commitment that it was a commitment I made, but I also realized that I needed to, it was important to walk through that very fearful, you know, the fear of being seen. I mean, it's funny, I'm up here. But there is some old fear of being seen, or fear of all that you felt ashamed of, you know, being out in the open. And I didn't do it just to do that, because that's another thing. I didn't do it to be, it's not a sensationalistic thing, and that's not what I wanted. I didn't do a mommy dearest or anything like that. I love my mother, you know, my parents. And I wanted to be honorable in what I did. And I thought it might be helpful. I thought it might be, that's what drove me too, is I thought, well, it'll be helpful to see what is here. I don't feel that my life is necessarily artful, which I found out when I was trying to make it fit into short stories, because there weren't neat arcs, you know, where suddenly she understands this. No, she goes through this 100 more times until she until she understands this, you know.
Well, I think it will be helpful. In fact, we were talking backstage about trying to get some copies to bring to the girls that we work with that are incarcerated teens, mm-hmm. who also have, you know, stories to tell, but not necessarily the mechanism for telling them. So I would love to be able to share this with them. I think it would be very helpful.
Also, yeah, and I think there's something about that, because in this society, the overculture, I call it, there are some stories that are okay to tell, and some people's stories that are fine to tell. And you see their stories, you know, at least that make it. When's the last time you saw a Native person at the Academy Awards? Saw a Native person in any of these shows? Any show that you see that you saw a Native person, you know, in any television and any internet story and any movie? Except, you know, with the cavalry chasing them.
Or in a really cliché.
Or very clichéd. When is it, you know, you don't. We've been basically mm-hmm. disappeared from the story culture of the world. Yes. Yeah. Irene's great. So, yeah, I mean, and there, you know, and there are a lot of stories, and there are a lot of people writing stories, but you don't, you know, it's... So I think it's important, you know, we all have stories. There's stories. I mean, if you talk about, you know, ancestors' stories, everybody in here has an incredible story about some in the family about how, you know, there's all kinds of stories. A lot of them you don't hear, or people hide them. They come up. I just found some incredible story that I would never have guessed come up. I'm not going to talk about it right now in the family, but it just blew me open. Mm. And I realized somebody who had kept it for shame, and there was no reason to be ashamed of it, but they felt such shame. But I think that, it's important, you know, our stories are, they're all related too. I mean, if we were to sit here long enough and start talking to each other, we would find out how everybody in here is related in some way or the other.
Let's do that. That would be fun. We have another question somewhere.
And there's some questions down here. There's a couple of people down here.
Yeah. I was wondering, so just a little, you mentioned trying to allow that ancient voice to communicate through you, kind of, talking about your ancestors and kind of allowing their voice to come through you in addition to your voice and kind of let that inform you. I was wondering what you thought about, especially as a Native American, what is lost when we actually lose the language of the ancestors. Like I'm studying Welsh right now because that's the language of my ancestors, and I'm doing that as a way to get to know where I come from better. And I was wondering what you felt about not just the message, but the language that the message comes through.
I think it's important. I've been learning Muskogee. I've been writing some songs in Muskogee language. And every time I go to my lesson, I learn all of this. Everything is in it. It's like an encyclopedia of mythology, and everything is in the language. And it makes me sad to think this country, I mean, including the indigenous people, over 500 tribes now, in a lot of different languages, a lot of them dying, people barely holding on. My tribe, we still have a lot of our culture. But even then, I just went to a meeting with all the Mikos, or the heads of the ceremonial grounds, you know, talking about a lot of issues. I like being in those kinds of meetings, but, you know, we're at a crisis. I think we who have a lot of culture, there's a crisis point. And then I always think of Sven Håkansson, Aleutic, who's almost, his tribe, they had almost nothing. They didn't even have the song. They had lost the songs, practically all of them. Wow. And within 20 years, they brought a lot of it back. And one of the stories I love is, it was there was a Haida group that had kept some of the tribe's songs because the people said, you know, they lost a lot. I mean, the Russians came in and they did horrible things, like line them up and shoot them through with cannon. I mean, just horrible things. And so they lost so much, but it's all come back through the efforts of the people. And Sven is a really wonderful leader. And anyway, this one tribe, they said, well, they said, you know, now that you've got your culture's coming back, we've been keeping songs for you. Isn't that amazing? We've been carrying songs for you. Yeah. And so they went back to this tribe and gave them their songs back.
Oh, that's great.
They had held them for them. They had kept them.
Wow.
And for a lot of our people that, you know, it's, you know, what, there are different wealth indexes. I was talking with my friend Barry Clark the other night, and he was talking, he'd been talking with this economist, talking about, you know, indexes of economic indexes or indexes of happiness. And money isn't necessarily, you know, it's not songs. You know, how many songs do you know, or how many dances do you know? I've been learning hula, as I love Hawaii. And it's like I'm learning a lot. I like having these, or, you know, my own tribal songs, or, you know, it's like, to have them, to be able to just have them right here. It's like having poetry. How many poems do you know? I made my students memorize poems, and they were horrified. But they were happy about it after. Anyway, you know, it's to have these things. That's how you're going to be rich. You're going to take with you what those things, you know, the knowledge.
Right, and then what they connect you to as well.
Yeah, what they connect you to. Mm-hmm.
Hello. So, Joy, my question for you is this. I know you were an acclaimed poet when you started to learn the saxophone, and I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what drew you to the saxophone and how the interplay between music and poetry. for you.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, Joy.
Yeah, I wanted to play saxophone as a kid. That's in the story, too. I wanted to I loved music, and I was forbidden to sing, and then the band teacher wouldn't let girls play saxophone, so I quit music, and I walked away from it. And then when I was about four, and what I liked about it is it sounds like it was a way for I could sing like Aretha Franklin, but without, I don't have her kind of voice, you know. It was a way to sing. It was a way to sing in the way that it was, you know, that it can do on it can't do on any other instrument. Mm-hmm. And then when I was about 40, I decided I was going to learn to play saxophone. And that's everybody great. Was like, I even had a good friend of mine say, "You're going to ruin your poetry. What are you doing? You're wasting your time. You know, you're a poet. You cannot do this, you know." And of course, she heard me early on. And and I learned to play in public, and I went through major stage fright and all that. But it's about the voice. It's really about the voice. It's another expression of voice. Mm-hmm. And I think that what I see is that poetry, music, and dance came into the world together. And I started realizing that or remembering that when I was looking around, well, where are the people in the poets? I'm actually related to Alexander Posey, who was a very well-known Muskogee poet, Creek poet, actually in the mainstream. You know, he was pretty well-known. He was a journalist and a poet. But I thought, well, where is our poetry? And I realized it's at the ceremonial grounds. That's where I hear the poetry and the language. Mm-hmm. And that it was in our way that, and then I thought, well, but you can't take it away from
music.
Yeah, it belongs with the music and it belongs with the dance. Mm-hmm. And then I started feeling how lonely it gets.
Just the words.
Right, but then I know that I lost stem stat when I started doing saxophone or putting music with poetry. Some people thought I even had people come up and say, well, I don't like your music, you know, I like your poetry without the music. And I think, well, it's two different things. It works either mm-hmm. way, I think. And because there are some hardcore purists, like, well, you don't mess with the poetry. It's like, wait a minute. You go back to the roots of all your forms and you're going to find somebody with a musical instrument at the other end, you know. And
We do a music songwriting workshop once a year, and the theme of the workshop is always songs happen when words alone are not enough.
Uh-huh.
So it's like taking a journey further.
Yeah.
You know.
And then one over here for a while, too. Yeah. Okay.
Hi, Joy. I'm one of the Write Girl mentees. And as we write, where is that line where you shouldn't share? You know, there's certain stories that we might feel are too personal. And maybe in your memoir, like, when did you set that limit of certain stories that you didn't want to share with, like, the public?
Yeah, and there are stories I don't share. I think some things don't belong out there. And some things you put out, you write for yourself. And sometimes it's good. I had a cousin who actually wound up in prison here in the state of California for doing something. Well, I realized because I've been in with girls in prison, I was telling Karen earlier, you know, I said, yeah, Alaska to go to prisons and jails, and there were four of them. And I realized that a lot of the guys were in there just for doing stupid things, you know. And then when I went to the women's prisons, I realized they were there for doing stupid things for their boyfriends, helping their boyfriends do stupid things, you know. But okay,
so anyway. So I was trying to think, now how was I getting to your question there about what you say?
And so how do you know when it's too much? How do you know, you know? Like, when do you know? I think, where is that line of when you know that's a private story or that shouldn't go into a book of my memoirs?
I think you have to pay attention to, you know, you've got, I call it the knowing in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But you really have to, it's really about listening. Poetry is about listening. Doing the story was a lot listening. It's so that I knew that, as I listened to it, that I had to cut 100, you know, that
the story had a certain integrity. It's about a kind of integrity. And so you have to keep a, you know, is this going to be helpful? Is it going to be hurtful? So there were a lot of things I didn't, put in here. And then somebody made a comment the other day, oh, do I get to hear about, you know, so-and-so and so-and-so in this book, you know, are you going to tell about this and that? And I said, no, it's not that kind of book. That'll be my next one when I give everybody's names. After wait till we're all gone.
Yeah, that's what they say, right? Right when everybody is dead.
But I think it's important. I know the story I was going to tell was that my cousin, she wound up, she'd never been, but she wound up driving a getaway car, and she was old enough to know better, but she was involved in stuff. And then she got out and wound up back in again on, you know, because she broke her probation. But we were talking, and she said, yeah, I said, you know, she was carrying all these stories that were too painful. And I said, you know what? Write them down. I said, I sent her a lot of paper. I got a lot of stuff into her, mm-hmm. and books and things. And I said, just write everything down. If you want me to read it, I'll be your witness. I will be your witness.
Yeah.
And I won't share it with anyone, and I will burn the papers if you want.
Yeah.
But I'll be your witness if you want. If you don't want me to read them, staple them together, and I'll hold them, and I'll take care of them for you. But it was important for her, and she did a lot better. She said gave her a great peace of mind. They were horrible things. She wanted me to read them, and they were almost, I could see why she could not bear them alone. Mm-hmm. So sometimes that's helpful. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's something very powerful about writing them down and saying, yes, this did happen.
Right.
I'm not crazy. This really did happen.
Yeah, and now somebody else knows about it. Even one other person in the world. It's a lot of what we do at Right Girl, is sort of hold the space for girls to be able to express what's going on in their lives, not necessarily to publish it in a book, but to have that experience of letting it out.
Okay.
Somebody patiently waiting over here, right?
Thank you. Okay. You were saying that you spent 14 years or so running away from the story. So I was wondering, did it end up propelling you through the book?
What, the running away?
What you were running away from, did that end up propelling you through it?
Well, I finally had to just give in to the story and face it, you know, and face the story. The difficulty was trying to put it together in a way. I like beauty and harmony, you know. And and it's very difficult to write things like that. And I always remember Meredith LeSueur, the wonderful writer and poet and human being. And I remember her talking to her, and she'd called to tell me that she was dying. It was going to be 3 years, but we were talking, and she says, "Sometimes I think that I made the suffering too beautiful." And I often thought about that. And then I was struggling because I wanted to write something beautiful, and there were passages in there, like we were going over, and there was one I didn't want to read because it was not. But then sometimes that's just part. We know the other because of the difficult parts. And I think that was a major turning point in my life as a human being, probably about 20 years ago, when I realized that that's part of the story. It's part of it. It's how I came or how we come to be who we are. And that was a major turning point for me. Mm-hmm. But then to write it down is another thing, or to make it, because then it becomes even more. But that was another step.
I think we have one more question over here.
Hello, Joy.
Hi.
I was thinking about what you had said about how, or what both of you guys had talked about how in other countries poetry has a more exalted place than here. And it's also true that in a lot of other countries that are going through a lot of political turmoil, it's the poets who are silenced first, or who people try to silence first. And I wonder what place perhaps politics might have in your work, knowing that or maybe referring to that?
Well, I think it has everything to do. It's not always so overt. It has been overt at times in my poetry, but it's always there. I think, especially being a Native person, speaking and then speaking about, you know, actually, I started writing poetry too. My poetry was in direct answer as being part of Indigenous rights movements, and the first poems I did came out of. Organizing and thinking about, I don't even know that I did all this so much consciously. It's just that I was young and I was in my 20s, and you start responding to, start responding naturally to what you see going on. And I am still not a good political thinker or somebody who can think, map out strategy on the spot, or speak in, political rhetoric beautifully, or, that kind of person. But I can, it takes me, I have to think about it and feel it out in another way. And that's, poetry became a way of doing, a lot of the poems. And She Had Some Horses kind of came out of that, in Mad Love and War, is being in that. And that's not ended yet. I mean, we're still involved in...
She's still infiltrating us.
Yeah. It's all still going on. I mean, this country. I mean, I don't want to get another hole. What's going on here? What's going on? Mm-hmm. We're losing ourselves. We're losing our words, our language. We're losing ourselves in this commodification of, we're losing poetry. And there is violence. I mean, there's more violence. I remember, I talk a lot to taxi drivers, and I was with this one taxi driver in New York City coming from LaGuardia, and he said, he was from a country that was at war, but he said he felt more fearful on the streets of America in New York because the violence was, you just never knew when it was going to erupt. It's erupting in our homes, it's erupting on our streets, and it's going, we probably have gotten so used to it, or we've been asleep, put to sleep by our toys and our, even just looking at cell phones, as I've been thinking a lot lately about, and I'm in it too, of how that's dramatically shifted the culture, or, the power of words. I was at a ceremony the other night. I didn't stay all night because I had to pack. I had all this stuff to do, and so it tells you something too. I've been usually up all night, and I'll be on tour for next weekend. But there's something very powerful about gathering together and listening and, you're all here and we're all here. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing that the screen can't replace that. The living word.
Yeah, so true. Yeah. So true. So I have a small gift for you. This is a gem. It's called Kyanite, and it's... a gem that's, I'm a rock person, and this is a rock that holds no negative energy, and that it's a powerful crystal to connect you to energy. So I want to give you that as a gift, as thank you for what this book has meant for me personally. I started by saying this book is a little bit like the feeling of a warm blanket, and I really mean that. There's this sort of comfort and compassion and beauty that really permeates all that you write in your poetry, but especially in your memoir. And I think it is highly instructive, as much as it is about your life, it's about all of our lives, and sort of going back to things that we have forgotten, people that we've not connected with, languages that we might want to learn, and ancestors that we've never met. And it's not really about that genealogy tree as much as about connecting with the things that they have to teach us to move us past our cell phones and our iPads and all those mechanical things and back to some of our roots. So I want to thank you very much for what you've given.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.